It's a pleasure today to have Marius Krum as our speaker in the Quantum Foundation seminar. And he will talk about space-time and quantum theory, insights via quantum foundations. Whenever you want, Marius.
Okay, thanks for inviting me. And thanks for coming to this presentations. So this is about how space and time and quantum theory are sort of restricting each other. And the plan is to take a somewhat unconventional approach by looking at quantum foundations and quantum information. So typically these approaches abstract away from like specific models in space and time. However, very often space and time do eventually pop up, and whenever they do so, they pop up in interesting way. So like these fields of quantum foundations, which I've shown here, do offer some unconventional ways to think about space and time in quantum theory. And two of these will be my topic of the talk today. So the first of these fields I will discuss is covered in a paper by me, Andrew Garner, and Markus Müller. And we consider the so-called device-independent formalism. So in the device-independent formalism, one considers some abstract boxes. And these abstract boxes get an abstract input, which is an integer from a finite set of integers, and some abstract output, also an integer. And one doesn't assume anything about the inside of the box, not even that it's classical, quantum, or anything else. And the most typical scenario in this approach is the Bell scenario. And there one has two of these boxes and two agents inputting integers and getting integers out. And typically one assumes that there's an entangled quantum state inside if one actually does this experimentally, although the framework itself does not rely on such an assumption. And all that matters is the probability table of the outputs given the input. Now in the Bell scenario, one important assumption that is motivated by special relativity and its locality is the no signaling assumption. So if the two agents that share like two boxes are very far away from each other, then the box statistics that one agent sees should be independent of the input of the other agent who is far away, because otherwise the statistics of the boxes could be used to send messages. And on the level of probabilities, this is implemented in the following way. So if one considers the marginal statistics one agent sees, these statistics should be independent of the input of the other agent, as one can see here. So we will focus on the case of two outcomes, and the typical correlation function is this correlation function here, that is just the probability for correlation minus the probability for anti-correlation. So far, so good. So far, everything is standard, but now we make one important change. So as I said, usually the inputs are just some abstract numbers and finitely many of them. However, in many experiments, that is far from the truth, because there the inputs are some continuous spatiotemporal geometric degrees of freedoms, like angles of of polarizers, directions of magnetic fields, orientations of objects, and time durations of laser pulses. And these space-time parameters are not just abstract labels, but they are physical quantities that can be transformed. And the transformation of such space-time parameters is typically described via a Leak group G. Like here, I've shown this for different concepts of rotations, like two-dimensional rotations of angles or three-dimensional rotations of extended objects. And if I say the word Lie group of transformations, then one can already guess that what will appear is some kind of representation theory. And indeed, that is the case. And we make one important assumption here that brings us away from full device independence to semi-device independence. And that is that the representations that matter here will be finite dimensional. So in semi-device independence, it is typical to demand that one does have a Hilbert space and quantum theory, just not a particular quantum model. And one just has a bound on the Hilbert space dimension. Now in that regard, our assumption is much weaker because we have not quantum theory, not Hilbert spaces, just these representations of the space-time transformations. So in quantum theory, one would start with unitary representations, but probabilities are real. So instead we will have real orthogonal matrices representing the space-time transformations. And we have a linear representation theorem that says for every space-time transformation, there's a representation matrix such that the probabilities are just linear combinations of the matrix entries of those representation matrices. So one important thing that Andrew and Marcus and I did in this framework is that we tried to describe the quantum correlations exactly, but not using any quantum assumptions, just assumptions how these abstract boxes react to space-time transformations. And what we found was that two helpful assumptions on space-time reactions of the statistics is that the assumptions that we make are transforming fundamentally and being unbiased after input averaging. So by transforming fundamentally, we mean that the box somehow contains like a vector-like physical object, meaning that the transformation and the representation that we have to consider is like transforming a vector. So this means we look at the defining or fundamental representation of d-dimensional rotations. And we also allow for a constant, meaning that there's a part of the statistics that does not have to react at all to rotations. And this already gets us to a Bloch vector-like form. And we can get even closer to the usual Bloch vector form if we make this additional assumption that is unbiasedness after input averaging. Like as an equation, that means if we take our statistics and rotate over all the inputs, then the output probabilities should be uniform. And that might look strange at first, but it's actually quite reasonable. Because let's say we really want to measure like a direction of a spin or whatever. What we really do then is that we define sort of an axis along which we measure. And the directions we call plus and minus are usually just convention. So whether we say we have plus one in plus x direction or minus one in minus x direction is convention. And if that holds true, then we have an equation like this here. And then this unbiased after input averaging is automatically satisfied. One last concept that I need to introduce is like this sort of counterfactual scenario that instead of following the usual Bell scenario, the agents get close to each other again and talk to each other. And let's say first Bob uses his box. He inputs a Y and gets an output B. And then he tells Alice that he did this. And Alice uses this new knowledge to update her local probability distribution in the way that it's defined here. We call this a conditional box. And now what we found is that the quantum 2-2-2 correlations, meaning two agents, Alice and Bob, two inputs, input values, and two outcome values. So these quantum 2-2-2 correlations are exactly the 2-2-2 correlations one can get if Alice and Bob have boxes that would that answer to d-dimensional rotations each, And the conditional boxes must transform fundamentally and must be unbiased after input averaging as just defined. And at least for the quantum 2-to-2 correlations, we achieved our goal of classifying these quantum 2-to-2 correlations just using general abstract statistical boxes and their responses to space-time transformations.
Sorry, did you say you get the quantum correlations just from these simple assumptions?
Only the quantum 2-to-2 correlations.
Okay, the quantum 2-to-2 correlations. Okay.
Yes, and it's not clear how to generalize this to more complicated cases. So if you want, I can explain more about this later on.
Marius, I didn't quite understand why you needed to do this conditional box to recover the correlations. What you don't recover the correlations if you don't have this communication from Bob Talis?
It's difficult to say like where exactly things don't work out. Like we were struggling a lot to actually make this work out in detail, and we changed our assumptions quite a lot. So I cannot really say what is exactly going wrong. But like one thing I should point out is that this has to work in both directions. So perhaps I should go into some more detail then, because there were two questions. Like in one direction, we essentially used a result by Howard Barnum, and which was generalized by Matthias Kleinmann, that if one has like some theories that locally look like quantum theories, so essentially Bloch balls, then what one can get if one combines them is just quantum correlations. So this is what we used in one direction, but we also needed the other direction. And getting that was much more complicated. But like for this other direction, the proof is quite long, and I don't see where exactly it would go wrong then.
Could I maybe ask a related question? So in these boxes, you assume that they transform under the fundamental representation of SOD.
Yes.
So presumably this then kind of restricts quite a lot the type of systems that could be in the box, right? They'd just be, if I guess, by Siebel's, they'd be the generalization of the Bloch ball, but to arbitrary dimensions. So, okay. So in this sense,
So like I just mentioned this result by Howard Barnum, and what we essentially have here is that locally we do have quantum theory just from our space-time assumptions, because we have something like Bloch balls. And they are still d-dimensional Bloch balls, so not really Bloch balls yet. But yeah, we already are very close to quantum theory here locally.
And so you don't assume local tomography then, right? Because to compose d-dimensional generalization of Bloch balls, I think you need to not have local tomography.
No, we are not doing this on the level of GPTs. Okay. Like originally, all of this was formulated GPTs, but what was actually published does not use GPTs in any way whatsoever.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so I think the last thing that I said are the quantum 2-to-2 correlations, right? Just to make sure I'm... Okay, I must admit that I lost track. So let's start at the more practical scenario of having angles as inputs. So here again is our bipartite scenario, and each agent inputs an angle, like an angle of a polarizer or whatever else one can rotate. And so, because we now have probability functions and correlation functions that depend on angles, one can already guess that what we will get from our linear representation theorem is some kind of Fourier series in those angles. And indeed, that is the case. And because we focus on finite dimensional representations, that means that we will get a truncated Fourier series. And this will be very important, because that means that our probabilities and correlations are smooth in those angles. So the first thing one considers in Bell scenarios is typically local hidden variable models. just to repeat shortly what that is, local hidden variable models are supposed to capture what it means for the statistics of Bell scenarios to have a classical explanation. And in addition to the boxes and the inputs and outputs of the agents, one also considers some shared global past, which is described by classical hidden variables. And what one requires then is that if one explicitly takes into account this shared past of the boxes and their propagation, then because the agents are separated from each other, their probabilities should factorize. Now, in the usual Bell scenarios, one only considers finitely many input values. And in our scenario, we now have angles as inputs, and angles don't take finitely many values, but continuously many infinite values. And still, the local hidden variable model has to work for all of them. So one might wonder, usually one rules out local hidden variable models by the strength of correlations. But might it be possible that just the shape of the correlations already prevents the existence of a local hidden variable model? And in a certain sense, we could show that the answer is no. So more precisely, we considered weakly fluctuating correlations. So in our theorem, this is some constant, more precisely the constant term in the Fourier series. And if our correlation function only weakly fluctuates around that constant, then one can find an explicit local hidden variable model. Okay, then let's turn to the exact opposite of the existence of local hidden variable models, which is called Bell non-locality. And to show that a local hidden variable model cannot exist, one typically uses so-called Bell inequalities. Those are inequalities that must be satisfied by all scenarios with a local hidden variable model. So if one can show that statistics violate a Bell inequality, then there cannot be a local hidden variable model. And the standard example is the CHSH inequality that only uses these correlation functions that I already introduced. Now, to state our result, we need one more concept, and that is the concept of the relational part of a correlation function. So the relational part of the correlation function considers again the truncated Fourier series, but only takes the terms that only depend on the differences of the angles. And what will be important to us shortly is that we can get this relational portion from the original correlation function by adding a shared random angle to the inputs of both agents and then averaging over the shared angle. And now we have everything that we need to formulate our theorem. And that essentially says that strong but diverse relational correlations are non-local. By this, we mean that we have two distinguished angles. And the relational correlations for one of these angles must be sufficiently close to one, while for the other angle, they must be sufficiently far away from one. And if that is the case, then the total correlation function, the original one, will violate the so-called Braunstein caves or Shane CHSH inequality, meaning that there will be Bell non-locality. And with this theorem, we can formulate something that we call the Bell-Witness protocol. So in this Bell-Witness protocol, one takes advantage of the fact that by using shared random angles, one can project down on the real relative portion of the correlation function. And more specifically, what happens is that there is in the beginning a random number generator uniformly generating a shared angle psi getting sent to the agents. And then one of the agents, Alice, chooses an angle theta plus or theta minus and adds that to the shared angle, and that's her input to the box. Bob, on the other hand, doesn't do anything. He just puts the shared random angle into the box and doesn't make any choice. And this one repeats many times, calculates the statistics, uses this projection formula to the relational portion and then can check the theorem for Bell non-locality. So we called this Bell witness because it's quite different from a usual Bell test. So one obvious difference is that Bob doesn't make any choice at all, and that is quite remarkable. And this works because we made this extra semi-device independent assumption that gave us a truncated Fourier series as our correlation function. And that was important because in the proof of our theorem, we did a Taylor expansion with error term. So if you look more carefully here, you see here like this order of something that has like this J dependence here. And that's precisely from the Taylor expansion we did. Like this is the error term. Okay.
Mary, so, could I interrupt you and ask a few questions?
Yes.
If you go back to the relational, your theta plus and theta minus,
yes.
Am I right in thinking that standard Bell tests if I think of the standard Bell test where say Alice is measuring, you know, these measurements on the block sphere and Bob's measuring mm-hmm. these ones, you know, the horizontal, vertical, and the two diagonals. If I calculated what the relative angles in those cases would be, you know, there wouldn't just be two of them necessarily. So like most Bell tests, I would say there's sort of like more than just two relative angles between Alice and Bob. And so they can't necessarily be framed in terms of, you know, what the behavior is for these two choices of relative angles. Have I got that right?
I think so, yes. So perhaps to be more specific, like what we used to prove our theorem was like a special version of the CHSS inequality, where like a Bronstein-Caves inequality, where we add up many of the CHSH inequalities. And in this chained CHSH inequalities, we actually had to use a lot of angles. So it would be like, if one really wanted to compare this to the violated inequality in that case, like one would have like a lot of angles that actually matter. So like I've shown this here in the figure in the appendix, like this is like an overview over the angles that we actually use in the violated Bronstein-Caves inequality in our setting. So there's a lot of inputs that the agents had to consider if they wanted to do this directly and fully device independent.
I see. And that corresponds to many relative angles as well, not just many angles locally on Alice's Bob, but the differences in their angles, the set of such differences is of large cardinality. Is that what you're saying?
I guess, but it sort of boils down to like this equation that is shown here in the box.
Because the equation in the box makes it look like it does boil down to just a phi plus and a phi minus. So I feel like I'm still not understanding. Is it the case that whenever Alice measures an angle theta, Bob is measuring an angle, you know, or sorry, let me say her angle's phi. Is Bob always measuring phi plus theta plus or phi plus theta minus? Is it that sort of situation?
Yes, that is what's going on. And your angle phi would be like the randomly distributed angle then. Let me show where we are. Yeah. So, in our Bell witness protocol, there's like this shared random angle. And this alpha is set to be theta plus or theta minus by the agent Alice.
Okay. I see. And
this is the only instance where choice happens.
So it, when you describe it that way, it seems like Bob does have a setting and it's sort of like a random angle. And then Bob, Alice's setting is necessarily a particular
a
function of the angle that Bob has chosen. or not chosen, but sort of generated at random.
Yeah, like this is no signaling, right? So Alice cannot make her angle dependent directly on Bob's choice. And indeed, Bob doesn't have a choice. Like what Bob inputs into the machine is dictated from the outside, from this random number generator. So in particular, Bob does not need a random number generator on his own.
I see. So I think if you, on your, this probably answers my question. If you go to the slide where you had a little kind of causal picture of what the Bell scenario looked like.
Yes.
Yeah, like on the right here. At first I thought that can't be right, because if I interpret that as a causal structure, then I know I can't violate Bell inequalities for that causal structure. But the way I think I would have drawn it is that you've sort of got a beta setting for Bob and then a common cause acting on alpha and beta. And that yes. is something for which you can have Bell inequality violations. So your common cause of alpha and beta sort of chooses beta at random, chooses alpha to be either, like beta plus theta plus or beta minus plus theta minus. And that's your context. Sorry to interrupt, but I have one more question, which is why is this different from a Bell test? It's so far, it seems like it's just another way of doing a Bell test to me. So I didn't understand what it's lacking to be a Bell test.
To actually check our theorem, as I said, we had to put in this extra assumption. Like in the end, let me see. Where do I have it? Here. So what one will get without our assumption is like this particular inequality here. So far we didn't use the fact that there is like this truncated Fourier series. However, the last step of our theorem, what it does is it makes this Taylor expansion around this small parameter delta here, and then chooses delta in some optimal way. And this last step cannot be done without having the guarantee that the correlation functions are sufficiently often differentiable in the angles. And of course, this is an issue that never comes up if one only has discrete inputs. But now we have continuous inputs, so we must somehow guarantee that these correlation functions are well behaved in the inputs. And this we guarantee by our semi-device independent assumption. And
okay, what I guess I'm confused about is like usually to say it's no longer device independent, it would have to be some assumption about the cardinality of lambda, the local invariant variable. But to say you've got an assumption about the nature of the setting variable, I mean, that usually I don't think of as spoiling device independence. Like if I say I have a discrete variable, or if I say it has a sort of bound in the representations of the group that act on it, that just means it's a particular kind of Bell scenario. But why does it spoil the device independence?
Like it's only a weak spoiling of device independence, but in principle, one could argue that these correlation functions might have like arbitrary unappealing dependence on the angles. Like these correlation functions could be fractals and could be nowhere continuous and something. And I do think this would still be compatible with the device independent formalism. But we explicitly rule out these device independent boxes that have such an unappealing dependence on the angles.
Okay, thanks.
So one thing to add, hi Rob, without the assumption, we always have a local hidden variable model. That's just to add that.
Okay. But yes, that was a good breaking point actually, because after having thought about classical spacetime parameters now in device independence, we will turn to the next topic that I promised in the beginning, which would be quantum reference frames. And this was a topic together with Philip Hoehn and Markus here. And first, let's say something about what we mean by quantum reference frame. So reference frames, we all know, they are usually used as abstract mathematical tools, but they introduce coordinates that must be physically measured if they have some meaning. And they can be measured perhaps via clocks for time or with rulers in space. And now it might be reasonable to identify the reference frames with the physical devices that measure the coordinates. If one does this identification, reference frames turn out to be physical objects. And now our theories of radiation and matter are quantum theories. So we have quantum objects, and that means we should look at quantum reference frames. Now, quantum reference frames have been along for quite a while. And the first thing Marcus and Philip and I did in our paper is to disentangle two broad different approaches. So one of these approaches is the one that Rob here has worked a lot on, which would be quantum communication, so communication of quantum information. In quantum information, we really like to talk about the computational basis. But despite the word computational, every basis corresponds to some choice of physical degree of freedom. And for agents, it might be difficult to establish what these physical degrees of freedom are like to each other. Like here in this example, there would be like Bob in his separated lab. And he demands spin up electrons from Alice. Now they can just communicate, so he demands spin up electrons. So they can communicate, but other than that, don't see each other's lab. And then Alice in her rotated lab asks what Bob actually means by up, like. And now the question is, how can these agents actually define a common notion of up? Like, how can they establish a shared computational basis? A very different approach is the one we call the structural approach, and one right motivated sort of by using like a quantum cosmology like thinking, where one says eventually like the big goal would be to have like a good description of the entire universe. So now, of course, the universe doesn't have an external observer. If one demands that quantum theory should be fundamental, nonetheless, one needs some relational reformulation in which the states already include all the observers. Now, this kind of arguing does raise some questions. Like, we will never write down a wave function of the entire universe, right? And all observations and measurements will only ever be about a finite part of the universe. Now, like, how can we get this like relational thinking of not having an outside observer of the universe? And the fact that experiments will always have an outside observer, how can we get these two descriptions to agree? So for that, we consider a particular scenario in which we have a large quantum system, and that quantum system can contain observers if one wishes to, and there's an outside observer. Now, to bring in the idea of having something relational, we consider the possibility that the agent only has some kind of bad reference. So that the bad reference frame might not define all global absolute properties. For example, the agent might not be capable of really defining a global origin well enough. And the question is, what can this observer measure? What are good descriptions? And to be more specific, we would like to first look at some particular example. So the standard examples considered in these relational quantum reference frame approaches are distinguishable particles in one dimension. And our mathematics will get complicated enough, so at the beginning we keep it simple. And we focus on a finite dimensional analog with periodic boundary conditions. Just having particles, distinguishable particles, distributed along a ring. Like in this example, our first particle is at position 7, particles 2 and 3 are at position 1, and our fourth particle is at position 3, and we write this into such a ket. However, we do consider some great generalizations that we call G-systems and have appeared in a similar form already in Tom's and Anne-Catherine de la Hamet's paper. And this is inspired by noting that on the ring, we can identify particle positions with the global translations that gets a particle there from the origin. So what we do is we consider again our Hilbert space on the ring that is defined by the position eigenstates. And first we replace the positions by the transformations that get you there from the origin. And then we replace the specific group of translations with an abstract group G. So our new generalized positions are now abstract group elements. And as I said, the mathematics will get complicated enough, so we focus on finite abelian groups. And because in general we have many particles, we will use a shorthand notation where we just make the position of the first particle explicit, usually calling it G, G prime or something like that. And other than that, we will have a vector H that contains all the positions of the other particles as measured from the perspective of the first particle. Okay, so our structure right now is that we have like a full Hilbert space H that needs an external reference or an external relatum to really be fully accessed. And if an observer does not have such a good external reference, then there will exist some states that cannot be distinguished. And this can be described as equivalence classes of states that cannot be distinguished without a good external reference. And mathematically, this means that for an observer without an external relatum, the full Hilbert space becomes some analog of a kinematical Hilbert space of Pitch-Wutters quantum clocks or constraint quantization. And that allows us to adapt some mathematical methods and tools of these fields. And we are really grateful for having Philip Hoehn on the project because he was our expert on actually making this part happen. However, I want to emphasize everything that we will consider here is physical if there is a good external relatum. So I never really said what it means for states to be indistinguishable. And for that, we consider a group of symmetry transformations. So these are transformations, more specifically physical transformations, because, so we consider physical transformations that do not change the internal or relational properties of a quantum system. That means that if one does not have an external relatum, then the symmetry transformations are unobservable. And they are an analog of gauge transformations. And this means that now we can rewrite our equivalence classes as just the unitary orbits of the states. However, different from earlier approaches, we will not average over the members of equivalence classes. And this will be very fruitful as it turns out. So perhaps-
Sorry, just to interrupt for a bit.
Yes.
I'm probably gonna say the same thing. I'll probably ask the same thing Philippe was going to. If you start with a pure state, are you saying that the G-twirled pure state is not in the same equivalence class?
Yes.
Okay.
So at least as long as your G twirl, whatever it's precisely defined to be, like we never said what the unitaries actually are, but we will not twirl here. We will never twirl here at all.
Yeah. Can I ask?
Yes.
Yeah, I just have asked, what is your goal here?
My what?
I mean, as a quantum gravity person and a quantum works on quantum cosmology, it just seems axiomatic that there is no observer outside the universe. That's what we mean by the universe.
Yes, so first of all, we want to ensure that like relational descriptions of like some finite system that can actually be observed agrees with the usual prediction of an outside observer. And
but why should they? I mean, if the principles that we base relationalism on, basically the identity of the indiscernible, are to have any force, then observers inside the universe, which is relational, are in a very different situation.
So perhaps one way one can make sense out of this is what we also have described in the paper. Like already in special relativity or general relativity, despite the coordinate independence, one introduces some extra fictional things. Like if one has a coordinate frame, that coordinate frame can define some kind of origin. And the important thing is that the physical laws of nature should not depend on this choice of origin. So the choice of origin is only a fiction. And similarly, one can consider like an outside observer with an external reference to just be a fiction. So one might adapt our framework by saying, okay, we have this fictional outside observer, and fictional here means that this external reference that would make like everything here measurable just doesn't exist. So we are always in this situation that this external velatum does not exist.
Yes, but then why do you go through all this trouble? Why don't you just say that transformations that are not, that don't change some internal relation are gauge, and you'll integrate over them or by that by then? As you choose what?
Perhaps one reason for that is okay, the universe does not have an outside observer. But then again, the actual considered models in these relational quantum reference frames, in these relational approaches, obviously do not describe the entire universe. Like they are nowhere close to that. It's just indistinguishable particles in one dimension. And if these approaches that just consider some small quantum system make predictions, these predictions should be compatible with the predictions of an outside observer.
Well, so, let me just try to make my point differently. In classical mechanics,
yes,
you have Newtonian dynamics, or you could have Julian Barbarous dynamics, if you know what I'm talking about.
Pardon, I didn't understand the last part.
Julian Barbour and Bertoldi, where you use just relative coordinates, and they have different consequences. The Barbaresque dynamics, because there's no preferred center, no preferred origin, has not only conservation of momentum, but zero total momentum is a constraint, and zero total angular momentum and zero total energy. So the dynamics done imposing the relational principles from the beginning has different consequences than Newtonian dynamics, exactly for the reason you're saying, already at the classical level.
Okay. So I don't know these approaches very well, but one question I have is, do they use a kinematical Hilbert space?
And I'm talking about classical.
Okay, then does this classical description use like some gauge degrees of freedom that are unobservable?
Well, you can do it different ways. You can build explicitly the configuration space of relative coordinates, or you can mod out by a set of gauge transformations generated by those conserved quantities, and then you impose the restriction that is zero total energy, zero total momentum, zero total angular momentum. You can get to it either way, classically. In quantum mechanics, you can do it via Dirac quantization or solve the classical theory, put yourself on the numerical configurations, build the quantum theory over that.
Okay. So one reason we chose this particular fiction of an external observer is that we wanted to get around like having unmeasurable quantities, sort of like gauge quantities. Like we don't want to have a kinematical Hilbert space here. We want that everything does have some physical meaning if it appears.
So that's beautiful if you can do it. For example, with spatial diffeomorphism, you can do it. And with space-time diffeomorphism, so far I don't see how to do it.
Okay. I'm not sure how does this relate precisely.
I'm saying that the details matter. And
yes.
Certainly, the quantization is different whether you constrain the coordinates on the physical configuration space and then quantize and then impose quantum constraints.
And that's, yes. And that's actually what Philip Hoehn has written several papers about.
Well, people have written papers about that going back to Dirac in the 1960s. But the fact that they're different, are you looking for an in principle argument that we should do one and not the other?
I'm not sure because like here we never do really any quantization at all, so.
Well, let's come back and discuss it.
Yeah, okay, so really maybe, well, later I can tell you something about that because I have a paper on this, so maybe we can discuss this later, maybe now.
Very good, go on, please.
Yeah, go ahead, Marius.
Thanks.
Sorry, Marius. I mean, it's been many questions, but I want to ask like a short follow-up on what David asked. Well, because he was right, it's basically the same thing. But like this idea of equivalence classes, you said something like two states in the equivalence class should be understood as like states that look the same for an observer that doesn't have access to this external stuff, no external.
Yes.
But then it seems like a mixture of two states that look the same should also look the same, or at least like. But it's not the case in your definition of the equivalence class. So how should I think about this?
So if you really wish to, I guess you can take mixtures. It's just not that we do this, like for large parts of the work, we actually focus on particular states, particular pure states that we called alignable. And I guess you can do this mixture, it's just not that for our results, we just don't take this mixture because we find interesting things if you don't take it. Like it's not just the statement is wrong that if you take the mixture that it won't be indistinguishable. It's just that you throw away some information of the outside observer, and this information can be quite interesting. Like this is what I will come shortly to. Okay, where did I actually stop? Yeah, I mentioned the unitary orbits. Okay, so like I think I didn't define yet what symmetry transformations we actually consider. And on our generalized position G systems, what we define to be the internal relations or the relative properties are in our case the relative positions. So we pick out the positions as being like our favorite bases here, and we will call them classical configurations. And on these classical configurations, we first demand that classical configurations get mapped to classical configurations. So there's no new quantumness introduced by symmetry transformations. And on such classical configurations, we demand that our relative properties of choice, so the relative positions, are conserved. So this has also in some way already appeared in the papers of Tom and Anne-Catherine de la Hamet, although with a different motivation or a different context. We also have a third axiom that isn't strictly necessary because qualitatively everything will continue to hold, but it makes the symmetry group much simpler. And that is, if two states are related to each other by a global translation by G, then a symmetry does not change that fact. So explicitly, what our group of transformations looks like is that we have conditional global translations. So these are the global translations, and they are conditioned on the relative particle distances. This is shown like here in this picture. So we have these particles, these three of them, and there are the relative particle distances here, and the unitaries look at the distances and then perform a global translation that depends on these distances. And now we are almost in the situation that we can recover important parts of Flaminius and Ann-Kathrin's and Thomas' paper. So first we adapt the states that were considered by Ann-Kathrin and Thomas, which are like these states that can be interpreted as fixing a reference frame to a particle. So one puts one particle in the origin, and the rest of on the other particles gets interpreted as the point of view of those particles. And we call the states that are symmetry equivalent to such states, we call them alignable. And now, how are these point of views of the particle related to each other? They are related by the by discrete versions of the quantum reference frame transformations from Flaminia. This is the quantum reference frame transformation. So one applies a global translation that puts one of the particles into the origin. And here we have this parity swap. And now, even if one doesn't like the concept of the point of view of a quantum particle, or doesn't like the idea of having superpositions of observers observe each other, we do get the quantum reference frame transformations simply as symmetry transformations that do not change the internal relations. And that is one of the reasons why we took not mixtures and just focused on pure states here. Because if one had taken like a G-twirl, for example, one wouldn't have been able to distinguish between different representatives anymore. And here the quantum reference frame transformations exactly pop up as relations between different representatives.
Marius, you still have 10 minutes.
Okay. Then it will be helpful to mathematically to consider states that are actually invariant under symmetry transformations. So we have a finite abelian group, right? And that means that the irreducible representations will be one-dimensional and agree with their characters. And we can define a basis, of a normal basis, in this rather abstract looking way. And these states now have the wished for property that if one applies some global translation, perhaps a conditioned one, then only a phase gets acquired. Like in the special case of particles on a ring, this looks like a discrete Fourier transform. So one can think of this character label as some generalized total momentum label. And among these invariant states, there exist some states that are completely invariant that never pick up a phase because they use the trivial representation. And we put them all in a Hilbert space that we called HFIS, because apparently it's closer to the notation that one uses in constraint quantization. And our method of choice was to consider operator algebras. And we have a big one and a small one that we consider now. And the big one are all those observables whose expectation values do not change under symmetry transformations. Now in the small in the small algebra that we called relational observables, one just considers the operators that live on the completely invariant states. And I will often just say completely invariant as an abbreviation for that. And then the big algebra is given by the small algebra plus operators that are diagonal in this new basis that we defined up to the trivial representation. And that means that only the small algebra actually considers the interesting quantumness, like all the coherence. So one important part of our paper was that we wanted to describe changes of particle numbers. So usually, what would one want? Like, one would want that the embedding in some sense should not change the particles that get embedded, and one would have a notion of doing nothing on the new particles that get added. And now it is important to note that notions like entanglement can depend on the perspective, and there's like one particularly excessive version of this realization, which is called the paradox of the third particle in a work by Angelo et al. And the paradox works as follows. So at first one considers a state, a superposition, in which the first particle is considered to be the origin. And the state is chosen such that the third particle completely factors out. And as long as I only consider the first two particles, it seems that the third particle is completely irrelevant. But now if I take the perspective of the second particle, the other two particles get entangled. And now it seems that if I remove the irrelevant third particle, then I might collapse the superposition. Now the question of the paradox is what is really going on. And to take a systematic approach, we considered embeddings, and we wanted to preserve the essential structure of the defining structure of our operator algebras. So embeddings should be injective, and they should be compatible with the essential structure of the algebra, so compatible with superpositions, products, adjoints, and it would be nice if they conserved the unit element, but we will relax this later. The standard example for an embedding would be to describe doing nothing on the new systems as tensor identity. And one can get the partial trace, which would be the opposite of the embedding, by just considering the Hilbert-Schmidt adjoint. Okay, and now first we consider the larger of the two operator algebras, and we want to define like what we mean as an embedding from the particle point of view of the first particle. So in the usual quantum FOV, the tensor one standard embedding would just take the original matrix element and add some component comma j in both of them and sum over that. And our new definition of the embedding takes this privileged basis that we had before and does the same thing. Like here's again the new plus j, and we sum over all of them. Then also the partial trace takes a similar form. So in the usual partial trace, one would just sandwich between with two vectors g and g and sum over that. And that's also what our new generalization of the partial trace does here. And one can introduce not just alignable of states, but also alignable observables. And we focus, and if one has done that, then there is a theorem that the embedding we just defined is actually the unique embedding of such alignable observables into alignable observables of a larger system, which essentially, let's start like this. Like one considers observables from the point of view of particle one. And on these observables, the embedding acts essentially just as tensor identity, like the standard embedding. This is with the caveat that one has to project down into the white algebra again. And we have many generalizations of that allow to go to different frames than the ones attached to particles, like the center of mass frame, for example. And the entire problem or unappealing thing here is that everything depends on the choice of particle and frame. So one might wonder whether that is necessary. And perhaps the first approach, the first guess would be to look again at the standard embedding and do this minimal fix of projecting down into the right algebra again. Now, does this work? And on the big algebra, this sadly does not work. Like the multiplicativity fails, and that is quite bad. But on the small algebra, the only problem is that the unit element is not preserved and that the Hilbert-Schmidt joint is not trace preserving. So it seems to be not a good concept of a partial trace. But it turns out that it actually is, and we can give this physical meaning. And so let's see what this standard embedding does on the smaller algebra. Like, this is as close as we can get to tensor identity. And to understand what it means that we do not have a trace preserving generalization of the partial trace. To give this meaning, we considered, like, okay, we have the big quantum state and we apply our analog of the partial trace that we called relational trace. And we divide by the probability that the big state passes a test for the completely invariant states. So far, this density matrix, this reduced density matrix that we define here, can be subnormalized. But this turns out to be reasonable. And to see that, we consider an event, so a POVM element, that lives on the completely invariant states. And then if we Hilbert-Schmidt contract this with the reduced state that we just defined, this is a operationally meaningful probability. And more specifically, one asks, like, conditioned on the original, the big state, passing a test for the completely invariant states, what is the probability for this completely invariant event to give a positive answer? And the scenario is shown in this figure. So the big quantum state comes in, and one makes the measurement that asks, does this state live on the completely invariant states? And if the answer is yes, then one tests this other event, the smaller event that we just defined. And with this new interpretation at hand, we applied our relational trace to the paradox of the third particle. And we found that for the smaller algebra, for the relational operators, as we called them, removing the third particle does not collapse the superposition. So for the for what we can actually observe with this smaller algebra, it will look like the superposition did not collapse. And I guess I should finish now. And I thank for your attention. And now that I'm done, I feel much more at ease having like longer discussions about this. And just to help you guys find questions, I put up this summary foil here. So thanks very much for your attention.
Let's thank our speaker. Thank you. So I guess we can take questions. We have had many. I'm sure there are more. I cannot see everybody, so yeah. Okay, Rob, yes.
Hi, Marius. So I think I understood the notion of the completely invariant states, partly from your talk and partly from the paper. But correct me if I'm getting it wrong. So I'll first articulate what I think the distinction I have in mind is, and then I want to sort of push back. So if you like the am I right in thinking that the states you called completely invariant are those that don't even get a phase factor under the unitary symmetry?
Yes. Okay. Like, here you can see like this unitary you mentioned. This is the phase factor that depends on the character Right. And if the character is just a trivial representation, then there is no face.
Okay, good. And so another way of framing this would be something like the states that if I do this coherent twirling, the states that you're calling completely invariant are fixed by the coherent twirling, and these other states are not fixed under the coherent twirling map. Yes?
I guess, yeah, like they would, like the other ones, well, except for the...
Or another way to put it is that this coherent twirling map just is the projector into the subspace of completely invariant states, which is the one that you sort of picked out as the, the small algebra.
Yeah, yeah. I just have to try to imagine this in my mind to make sure, like, I know what you are getting at. Like, you want to sort of say that the face that appears here for the states that are not completely invariant, that the face, like, if I integrate over it, it gives me just zero. So that's
I do want to argue that I don't think the distinction between the phase being trivial or non-trivial is a physically significant one. So I want to argue that the distinction you're making between completely invariant and sort of merely invariant or something is, I don't think that's a significant one. And here's the argument as to why that. So from a quantum information perspective,
yes,
the way I would represent a state is not by its vector in Hilbert space, but by the density operator.
Right? Yes.
So if I look at not the representation of a symmetry by a unitary, but by the super operator, you know, U blank U dagger.
Yes.
Then the states in these different irreducible representations look exactly the same. So it's only relative to this unitary representation that you see this difference. But in my view, the physical symmetry should be represented by the super operator representation, because there's no significance to anything except the density operators. That, so to my mind, it's the super operator representation that's the physically relevant one. And therefore, the difference that you're drawing is not physically relevant.
Yeah, so first of all, what you are saying does pop up. So like I already mentioned that we have this diagonal part here in our observables. And the reason why this actually does pop up is exactly why you said, like, why one sees the face just on the like pure state, so just the cat, the face disappears once one writes down the density matrix. And that's precisely the reason why such states, despite having this global face, can be in the algebra of invariant observables. But like there will be a problem once one considers superposition of such states that can pick up a phase, because then the phase that was just a global phase before can turn out to become a relative phase. And that's precisely the reason why our algebras of invariant observables cannot carry coherence on these non-completely invariant states, because the global phase becomes a relative phase.
Okay, I think I understand better that you're, maybe not completely. Like, if just a simple example, if I have, say, three spin halves, and I'm doing collective rotations on them, let's go to four spin halves. So the representation of collective rotations on four spin halves does give me a J is equal to subspace, J is equal to zero subspace. Which is of this form, with that all the vectors in that subspace are transformed trivially under the collective rotations. So that would be like your invariant, your completely invariant states. But also in the J is equal to one subspace, I still have some decoherence free part. I still have a factor space which transforms trivially under collective rotations, and I can encode coherence there, right, which is invariant under collective rotations. So it's not as if the only place where I could encode quantum information is in that J is equal to zero subspace. I can encode it in the higher irreducible representations as well. It's just that they're now in this sort of a factor space form, where there's sort of a factor space that actually gets decohered by the collective rotation, and another one, which is the multiplicity space, where I can store coherences. So I'm not sure exactly whether I'm disagreeing with you, but it feels to me like you can store coherences in other irreducible representations.
Yes. So I must admit, so mathematically we can derive that this is true, but I also have some interpretational problems with this result. So I think in the paper we called this an emergent super selection rule. And I don't exactly understand its physical origin. So like I already pointed out that there is like this formal analogy with the total momentum, like that these characters can be seen as an analogy of total momentum eigenstates. And like the trivial representation would then just correspond to total momentum zero, while the non-trivial characters would correspond to total momentum non-zero. And it's not really clear to me why total momentum zero could carry coherence, while total momentum non-zero cannot carry coherence. Like we can derive it, but I'm not really sure why that happens, like physically, like what the intuition is, what is to happen.
I think that's a good example that if you've got some other degrees of freedom around that don't, that transform trivially under translations, then you can encode, then you've got multiplicity spaces for all the momenta and you can encode coherence in every one of them. The only thing you can't do is encode coherences by superpositions of different momenta, right? So the point is that if I tried to superpose in two different non-zero momenta, yes, I would decohere. But if I try to superpose states that only differ in the multiplicity index, but have the same momentum, then I can still have coherence, even if that momentum is non-zero.
Okay. If you talk about spins and things like that, what operations do you actually consider on them? Like, is it just some like unitary representation of some classical group, like rotations? Or is it like here where we have these conditional translations? I think this makes an important difference. And also something that was very important to Philip Hearn. Like, we don't have just global translations. We have global translations conditioned on the particle relations. And I think this is a scenario that is very non-standard in usual quantum theory. And would this correspond to the examples you are thinking of now? Like, what would happen there if you try to have some conditional transformations like we have them here?
I'm not sure what changes with these conditional transformations. So I don't know.
So like this was, I think it's, so this was something that was very important to Philip Hearn, like in our example. So Philip said that what one usually considers in constraint quantizations is just like a unitary representation of like the classical symmetries. Like what I really mean by that in our case is like just global translations, not conditional global translations, but what one would usually consider is just global translations. And now what was very important to Philip is what difference that actually makes. And what he found is that it doesn't make a big difference on like these completely invariant states, but it makes a really, really big difference on like these non-completely invariant states. Now I have to look then again what exactly the algebra would be like that one would get in this case. But yes, it is very important for us that we get at least the conditional translations, because it's the legit conditional translations that contain the quantum reference frame transformations. Just translations does not contain the quantum reference frame transformations. So we really have to deviate here from the usual thing.
So my guess is that the distinction between these conditional and non-conditional transformations probably doesn't match to the distinction we're talking about, that ultimately, like, as I see it, the constrained quantization literature has been focused on unitary representations of physical symmetry groups. And I think it was wrong to do so, it ought to focus on the super operator representations of those physical symmetry groups. And when it does, it will see that the J is equal to zero irrep in the angular momentum case, or the momentum is equal to zero irrep in the translation case, are not physically distinguished in any way from the other irreps. But maybe we should talk about this later, and we can open it up for other questions.
So maybe just a very general question. In the first part of your talk, where you're talking about these the classical variables, what's the sort of most ambitious project you could imagine sort of taking on in that kind of framework? You know, what is there some, because you proved some yes. results, but I have the sense that that was part of a much bigger, more ambitious project.
Yes, it definitely is. One big project would be to actually characterize all the quantum correlations just using assumptions on how box statistics react to space-time transformations. So we have only the quantum 2-to-2 correlations right now, and it's not clear at all how to generalize this. But one big project would be to classify all the quantum correlations just for space-time. And another big project would be to not just consider angles as input parameters, but consider other experimental scenarios one might have as well. Like, for example, one might say, okay, I have a box now. A box is an extended object. I don't know what is inside. But one thing I can do for sure is move the box around or rotate it or give it a Lorentz boost. And for all these different possibilities of what one can do to a box from the outside, it would be very interesting and I guess fruitful too to investigate what this already has to say about the box statistics, and to hopefully make it easier to find Bell witnesses and to discuss local hidden variable models. And of course, the long-term goal would essentially be to go to Lorentz transformations or even general diffeomorphisms, although it's not really clear what that means if one just considers like a small box.
Could one imagine going even a bit further? Because in what you describe, you take some classical sort of properties as given and then see what it implies for the box. But could there also be some traffic in the opposite direction, whereby the nature of your classical variables is determined by some considerations in the interaction between the box and the and some classical variables? I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, sort of back to sort of work that Marcus did on determining the dimensionality of space-time, but there may be a more general sort of project of that nature.
I guess, yes. So as far as I know, like the dimensionality of space-time, like Marcus' projects, were like usually on Bloch balls, and eventually it was always like that the d equals 3 case, like having three-dimensional space sort of corresponds to quantum theory. So here we aren't really classical yet. But I guess one could try to sort of get classical correlations from space-time assumptions too. And if one could not get that, that might even be more interesting. Like it would mean in a certain sense that having like this, these space-time assumptions in a certain sense already rule out classical theory. That would be intriguing as well.
Okay. And so this was a just one specific question. When you were talking about the chained, the Brownstein case, chained inequalities, and I didn't quite understand your angle settings. Because usually in the Brownstein caves, choice of angles, you have lots of very small angles and then one big angle. And that's how you get the sort of the violation of the inequalities. Do you have also, which means that they don't have a constant, most of them have a constant angle as you go around, but then there's also one very big angle. Do you have that in what you do?
I think yes, but let me understand again. So here's the formal definition of the angles we consider. And you already figured out, right? Here we have these many tiny angles that we add up. Okay. And I guess this theta plus might be the big angle that you're asking for, because like the difference between these alphas and these betas, that we have like this big gap theta plus here.
Oh, I see. Okay, now I see it more clearly. Okay, thank you.
More questions? Okay.
I have another, if there's nobody sure. else coming. So it's returning to David and Philip's question. So let me ask the question again in a third way, and then maybe you can clarify for me that, like you mentioned when the question was asked, that we would see how this became relevant. So the question was about why you're using the notion of equivalence that you defined.
Yeah.
So a different notion of equivalence class would be, you know, a set of states are equivalent if they all look the same under G twirling, right? Under twirling relative to your symmetry group. And so if I take just a simple example, again, rotation group, and now a single spin a half particle, the difference is that the notion of equivalence with respect to twirling would say everything in the block sphere is equivalent because they all map under this averaging of all rotations to the completely mixed state. Whereas your definition would take the block sphere and carve it up into an onion where every degree of purity is a different equivalence class. So the points, you know, the pure states on the surface, they're equivalent to one another because this is a rotation that connects any two of them. Yes. And the ones that are slightly mixed are equivalent because there's, and similarly, down till you get to the yes. center. Okay, so physically speaking, to my mind, if you don't have access to the external reference frame that allows you to define rotations, I don't see any way you could do an experiment that would distinguish the different layers of the onion. And that's why it seems to me it doesn't make sense to think of those as sort of inequivalent when they have no operational significance. The degree of purity, if you don't have access to that external reference frame, to my mind, has no operational significance. So that's my way of phrasing the challenge that David and Philip expressed. And now I just wanted to hear maybe more directly how you responded to that later in your talk by saying why this notion of equivalence is more interesting than one based on twirling.
Well, first of all, I think that the general notion of G twirling might be at times be too, let's say, brutal. Like it throws away a lot of information. Like, okay, I could imagine, like if I only get...
When is that information relevant? Like I agree that in this example...
If I get several copies of the state one after another, like in the beginning, I might not be capable of making the difference, but if I get many of them, I can perform perhaps some kind of tomography. Like for example, in the beginning, if Alice only sends one spin up electron to Bob, Bob cannot learn what spin up is, but after sending many, they can eventually establish a reference frame. And if I had used the G-twirl every time, then I would just have gotten the maximally mixed state. And with this, I would not have been capable of doing
that. That's not right. The G-twirling is defined relative to the symmetry group. And in this case, the symmetry group is collective rotations, not independent rotations on each spin. So you wouldn't twirl the first spin and then tensor it on to a twirled version of the second spin. You would just twirl all the spins together. And so, you know, you would like preserve the singlet state over two spins, for example. That would not be touched under the twirling. And again, I would say everything that is like all the extra information you would get by merely taking equivalence classes in terms of unitaries, so that would be like purity type information. You lose that information under the twirling, true. I just don't think that information is relevant for anything that doesn't have access to that external reference frame.
Yes, so I don't think this is like a fundamental limitation of our approach here, really. So Like if you want to like do the like the full twirling and consider mixed states, even if you started with pure states, it does work. Like we interpret our paper as sort of like starting like a new point of view. And this would be follow-up work one could do in this work. Like we haven't done it yet, but it's certainly compatible with, like what we really wanted to do is like propose our new scenario where one has like this outside observer without an external velatum. And everything else that we made is sort of like an example, like that we consider G systems, that we consider finite dimensional things, the specific things we did, like they are all like on the level of examples what one can do with this new perspective. And if one wants to say, okay, I also throw away the information that what was given to the agents was at least the pure states, then one can do that.
I also comment, that's okay. So the way I understood this focusing on equivalence classes and pure states was because it's the equivalent of like a gauge transformation. So it's, it's not so much in classical physics, you don't average over all possible gauges. You just pick a gauge and work with it.
Yes.
And so that would be my kind of, intuition as to why it's done that way. I guess it also falls in with like cosmological picture. So this maybe like a wider debate. Like I guess people typically in these constrained systems believe that, you know, the universe is in a pure state. So then you just fix a gauge rather than averaging over all gauges. And my third thought actually is for stuff like just a translation group, the G-twirl, it doesn't give you like a normalized state. It's not well defined because the Haar measure. So you can't really average over all translations, for instance. So I guess maybe in this work, for finite groups, it'll be fine. The G-twirl would be defined, but in general, for non-compact groups, it'd be a bit harder. So I think that's also reasons why people, when they look at continuous systems, don't G-twirl because,
Like there might also be one additional way how one can make sense out of this. And let's say we consider a slightly different scenario that the agent cannot distinguish some states without an external velatum, but the agent is promised that all the relevant states are pure states. Like we could just add this as an external additional promise. Then how would the agent actually describe this just using a density matrix? So like, if one does the G-twirl, then the information that the states are actually pure states with an external velatum would be lost.
So this is an example you give in the paper, right? Where you essentially, what you communicate is the purity of the states, I think. Where you have a density matrix is diagonal, and you just be communicating that it's a pure state, I think.
In what sense?
I think you have an example in the paper where you kind of have a reference frame for a qubit and the like information that's present is just the kind of purity. So you like just have a diagonal matrix. But maybe this isn't related to this, just what I thought immediately. Can I maybe follow up with a question if we have time?
Yes.
So here you picked kind of a finite abelian group. And I guess the paper, like for the change of reference frame, like Flaminio wrote, was for like, the translation group, for instance. Does this follow all, go through, do you think, to the translation group easily? Or do you foresee there being difficulties? Like, should the lessons from this, should I just think I can apply them to like arbitrary groups? Or should I think they're specific to the like finite abelian group case?
That's like a tough question. Like we hope that at least for abelian groups, everything will go through. But if one doesn't consider them to be finite anymore, one gets all these additional problems of topology and like well-definedness, because here we focused on position eigenstates. And if one would go to a continuous infinite dimension, like the real line, one would get already this problem that the position eigenstate doesn't really exist. And one would have to find good generalization or analog for that. Or would have to accept that if one has like something like this that involves a position eigenstate, that not all expressions one might write down might be mathematically rigorous. And these are some problems that one would certainly encounter. However, like just the general program of like having some notion of alignable states, thinking about symmetry groups and embeddings, we hope that this broad program works for many groups. But yes, to actually make the details work out, I think one will consider some significant problems, in particular for groups that are not even compact.
Okay, thanks.
So, anybody else's questions? If not, let's thank Marius again.